Welcome to our first episode of Poking Holes and Blinders. My name is Colin Fallenwider, and with me, as always, is Brian Height. And hey, man, we're finally doing this, right?
We are finally doing it. It's been forever, dude. We've been talking about this for, what, months?
Months.
And we're finally pressing record and saying some things, so I'm excited about it.
I'm excited about it, too. So we wanted to just kind of introduce ourselves and talk about what our vision of this is and why we're doing it. And go hike.
Yeah, I think that I just have a great time talking to you. And I think that sometimes our discussions get into some really cool areas that I think more people would benefit from thinking about situations in creative and fun and interesting ways. And to me, the conversations that you and I tend to have go those directions. And I thought, instead of just the benefit being for the two of us, maybe somebody else might get something useful out of the various ramblings that we have during our conversations. That's the reason I'm excited to have this. If for no other reason than, you know, if nobody else listens but you and me, we're having a good time talking and I enjoy hanging with you. So
I agree. Just kind of thinking about who I talk to more in my life. And it just happens that you are the person that I talk to the most in my life.
I don't know that your wife's going to be very happy about that.
I know, but I mean, that's just the way it is. One of the things that I appreciate about speaking with you is that you challenge me to think about things in a different way. And I think using this platform is a great way to kind of keep our growth going, as well as, like you said, maybe other people would think it's at least entertaining and hopefully informative. But I do believe, as we kind of got our motto together, that knowledge infused with compassion fuels better decisions. And I think if we can benefit from that, maybe others can. And, you know, maybe ultimately society as a whole. Let's get more knowledge about things, sprinkle some compassion on top of that, and then we all get to make better decisions. And hopefully that helps society. You know, better decisions has got to help society, right?
You would think. Yeah, the world is just such a complicated place, you know, and I think that there is a lot of certainty in a lot of people's minds about the best way to handle whatever, fill in the blank, however you want, whatever the issue might be. Here, most recently, we have the abortion issues and gun rights issues, and there's a war in Ukraine, any number of issues. And people seem to be very sure of themselves about what the right answer is. And I don't know. I'm not that sure. I tend to hang out on the fence, I guess, maybe more often than maybe I should. I don't know. Maybe it's a weakness that I have of some kind, but I see the complexity and I appreciate the complexity. I like the complexity. The complexity makes the world exciting. It makes it interesting.
Yeah.
It stimulates curiosity and it keeps me exploring and learning new things. And I love to learn new things. And part of the ways that I do that is talking to smart, fun people. And you're one of them. So here we are.
You're too kind to me. At least my parents tell me I'm smart.
That's good. Did they give you a trophy for getting up this morning, too?
No, that kind of stopped just a couple years ago. So the get up trophy.
All right.
I have a lot of them. I've gotten up a lot in my life. You know, it's interesting what you said about the certainty. I don't think it's a weakness at all. I actually think if you look at some of the greatest leaders that we've ever had in difficult times, that there's an element of doubt and uncertainty in them. Actually, I just watched Our Darkest Hour again last night because I love it. But one of the things that they propose is with Winston Churchill's "We'll fight to the last man" and that sort of gusto, that they propose that he actually had a lot of uncertainty about it. And one of the scenes in the movie is that he's just sitting in the dark in his bedroom and he's just like, all right, do I actually entertain peace talks with Hitler? Was that part of my job where he's, you know, totally opposed to it? But to be a good leader, that kind of doubt kind of comes into his mind. And then the king comes in to his bedroom and they start talking. And actually, one of the things that they say is that doubt and uncertainty actually is a better way of going about things. Because once you have certainty, then there's nothing, there's no information, there's no data, there's nothing that can be told to you that you're going to believe. So when you're 100% certain, then there's no room for growth.
When certainty exists, then it cuts you off from other information. It cuts you off from learning. And there's a quote from a Stoic philosopher whose name is Epictetus.
I'm sorry, before you get into it, like a Stoic philosopher, is that someone who just stands tall And still, is that stoic? What is this stoic philosopher?
Yeah, let me clarify that. There's a philosophy called Stoicism.
Oh, okay.
And Epictetus was a former slave, actually. And he learned philosophy from, it doesn't matter. I'm not going to give you a history of Stoicism, but.
Thank you for not wasting my time. I appreciate that.
Epictetus, one of the most influential Stoic philosophers that is out there. And he has a quote that he wrote. It says that he spoke, because actually he didn't write anything. He just, he taught, and one of his students wrote it down. But the quote is, "It is impossible to begin to learn that which one thinks one already knows. It's impossible to begin to learn that which one thinks one already knows." So if I think I already know what it is, if I'm certain about a situation, then it's impossible for me to learn anything about that situation. I cut myself off from gathering any further information.
Yeah, it's very nice that he had someone write that for him. That's pretty powerful. One of the things that our current political system, I don't do a lot of research. I think I should probably put that out right in the beginning. I kind of hear about things and then I'll research a little bit, but I do read a lot or get read to, because I'm a big fan of audiobooks. But one of the things about talking about in the political system is that there's really no room for people to say, "Hey, I was wrong." To just be like, they said it, and it's like, you know, I stuck by that 100%. And then when they say something else that maybe in the opposite direction, it's like, no, I wasn't wrong then, and I'm not wrong now. It's like, how can you not be wrong? But I think it's the perception of being wrong that for some reason they think that shows weakness. And in all honesty, if you never admit that you're wrong, then you're just an asshole, because of course you're going to make mistakes. But if you can never show that because of the political pressure, that's a hard way to live. In that book that we read together, not like, you know, we're by the fire together and like, that's an interesting chapter. Not that, but in the book called Think Again by Adam Grant, one of the things that he was pointing out in past political situations is that there's been some leaders that have actually admitted they were wrong. Then they said, "All right, we were wrong with this, but we could do better." It actually made that leader seem stronger in the view of the public, because then they see he's a human. He's open to making mistakes or admitting mistakes, and then you can grow from there and you actually get more support when you're able to face everything straight on, as opposed to trying to put some sort of political spin on it. That was the point I was trying to bring from the book.
I absolutely agree with that. And I'll just start here with the politics and the big people. Another Stoic philosopher was a Roman emperor called Marcus Aurelius. And Marcus Aurelius wrote, "If someone can prove me wrong and show me my mistake in any thought or action, I shall gladly change. I seek the truth, which never harmed anyone. The harm is to persist in one's own self-deception and ignorance." And that last part, I think, is so key, because if we believe we are certain, if we believe we're perfect, if we believe that we don't make mistakes, that we have it all figured out, that's a level of self-deception that can result in nothing but ignorance. We're not going to understand the world around us as thoroughly and completely as we can. And then to just bring it back to just the regular people level, what you said about the politicians, I mean, that just applies to friends. Like, if we have friends that do something wrong, are we better able to move forward with that relationship if the friend creates excuses or tries to justify what he or she did or puts the blame on us? Or are we better off just owning up? You know, I know when people make mistakes in my life, I really appreciate them just owning up. I'm not going to say it doesn't matter what they did, because it does, but I am willing to forgive a lot if somebody just acknowledges, "Look, that was wrong. I'm sorry. I will do better next time," or at least endeavor to do. Like, they don't even have to do better next time. They just have to promise that they'll try to do better. And I'm happy. I'm happy. I'm willing to move forward and let things go, because, you know, God knows I've made countless, innumerable mistakes throughout my life and will continue to. And I certainly hope that people will continue to forgive me. Enough people have so far. And I very much appreciate that. And I'm grateful for it. But I think that's important. So for people in our lives, when they make mistakes, we really appreciate when they just own up to what they do.
It's interesting, just to kind of flip that back from a personal level to a national stage. If that's how it is between friends, you just said that strengthens your relationship with them, right? So that on a political level, I understand like when you admit mistakes, then the other side is going to like drop bombs on you. It's like, oh, they don't know what they're doing. They're incompetent kind of thing. But if that works on a personal level, then that also can work on a national stage. Back to our darkest hour, even Churchill says that I've made lots of mistakes, but he's willing to grow and admit that. And he was actually one of the greatest leaders that brought us through World War II. Back to the thing about friends. I don't know if this ties in. I kind of think people that have comb-overs don't have good friends. I mean, if you're thinking about it, that's kind of an untruth that you're trying to cover up your head with hair from the side, right? But everyone knows. I just know if I tried to do that with my hair, if that was happening and I had to do a comb over, I know my friends would just ridicule me until I just accept the truth and just say, okay, you're right. And then just, you know, shave it off. So I just think people that have comb overs, maybe they just need to find better friends to help them see the truth of their hair choice.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. It's kind of a stretch to make that fit, but it was just something I was thinking about.
Yeah, that may be the quintessential square peg that you shoved right into that round hole. Not sure about that one.
I mean, if you reach for it, it's a lie and an untruth, and your friends help you see that, and then you get doubt about it looking good, and then you're finally able to accept the truth and grow from it. That's a stretch.
By that logic, you're lying to me right now.
It's not a comb over, dude.
No, because your hair doesn't look like that. You just told me before we started this thing that you put a bunch of product in it, because if you didn't put product in it, it would look some other way.
It would look awful.
So you're lying to me about how your hair looks, because how it looks right now is not how it looks.
It'd be different. I say, hey, dude, I just woke up. It just does what it does. That's a lie. I'm not lying to you. I'm like, this is what I did on purpose. This is a choice.
Well, the comb over didn't, the wind didn't blow it over there. The person made the decision to put his, I guess it could be her, hair into that position.
Wait, are you telling me that I should do different choices with my hair? I just want to be open.
I'm saying nothing about you. I think your hair is wonderful.
If I'm wearing blinders about my hair, I appreciate you poking holes into it so then I can accept the reality of the situation.
Yeah, well done there. I think your hair is a perfect choice for somebody who lives in a very windy place. Nobody will ever know if you've been outside or not. I think it's great.
Thank you. That's what I go for. That's what I go for.
So I'll tell you what. Wait, we haven't done this. Why don't we just do a brief little, you know, who we are and where we came from? I don't know, like not life story thing, but just how did we come to meet and come together in a way that we could do this thing?
It's a good question. So Brian, I didn't know if you knew this or not, but I had always wanted to be a stuntman. I always had. But I grew up in Colorado. I used to, my best friend and I, we had a daredevil club and we would just dare each other. Hey, I dare you to jump off that roof. All right, man. And then so we'd just jump off the roof. I always saw the action in film and television and I wanted to be one of the people that got to do that. I didn't know how to do that in Colorado, but I was a gymnast. I competed in high school and college, and then I started performing high diving shows at some theme parks. Then I did a stunt training workshop to pursue that stunt dream in Seattle. And then I moved to Las Vegas. I did a couple stunt shows there. I did a stunt show in Japan. And then I worked at Cirque du Soleil's O in Las Vegas for a couple years. And then I moved down to LA and I auditioned for a couple stunt shows. And one of them was the Batman and Robin stunt show at Six Flags. And fortunately, I got cast to be on the full-time team. And Height, you were already there. And you've been in that show for a couple of years, right?
Yeah, I've been there for, I don't remember how many years, but a few years at that point.
A few years. On the full-time team, what was cool about that is we would do a bunch of training. We call it training, motorcycle training, because we had some like motorcycle jumps in there and wheelies and stuff like that. It was a pretty fun set to just ride the motorcycles around. And we used to play tag. Do you remember us playing tag with the motorcycles? It was like the front of your tire had to touch the back of the other person's tire. The cool part about that is you just stop thinking about how to make your tire get like spin out kind of thing. You just, you know, throw it sideways and give it some gas and it spins away as the other person comes around. And such a fun way of playing tag. When one of us fell down, I mean, that wasn't like a time. You just went up and touched their back tire with the other tire. And then that's how we played tag. And I think one of the coolest things about that is it seemed like we were fucking around, but when you, me, and Brandon would also play tag with us too. Like when the three of us were actually in the show and we had our sequence, it was so exciting because we got so used to how each other ride. It was just fun. It was fast. It was really, really fun. And then when other people came in, they just didn't have that kind of experience. It was fine, but it just wasn't the same. From that, I did a Spider-Man, touring Spider-Man show. You got cast in that too. As one of the Spider-Men, actually, right? Ensemble and a Spider-Man cover. When we were out on tour, we'd always go to art museums, you know? It was pretty cool.
Yeah, and you tried to take me to the bowling museum in St. Louis, too. I remember that. That was back in the day when you didn't like any sports, just bowling.
Just bowling.
It. And you even argued that it was a sport.
Because it is was a on, sport.
I don't think it's a sport, but that's a whole nother story. But yeah, that was a fun tour. The thing that I remember about that is it didn't last long.
No.
But we had a brief period where we were boxing.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
And I remember one day we had a good one. I ended up walking away with a bloody nose. And I don't remember what you walked away with. I popped you pretty good somehow. But yeah, I just remember the crew because the crew was used to just being on regular theater shows. They had no idea how stunt people behave. And I remember they got the report. So Colin and Brian are on stage boxing. And there seemed to be a little bit of trepidation, but more confusion about how to handle that situation. They didn't really know what to do with that information that they got. That was just such a fun show.
I think it was your idea too. I can't imagine I came up with that idea. Hey, let's box. It probably went like this. You said, hey, maybe we should box in between shows. I'm like, no, why would I want to do that? And then you're like, no, come on, it'd be fun. I'm like, okay. I'm kind of a pushover and probably can get talked into a lot of things. But I'd never boxed before. I don't like being hit. So, but it was fun.
That's an acquired taste, I'm told. I haven't acquired it yet, but maybe one day. Yeah. I don't know.
But dude, that was so long ago.
That was. It was a long time ago.
And 2004. You know, one of the coolest parts of that tour, though, is we got to play Radio City Music Hall for like a week and a half. So I was Peter Parker, Spider-Man on it. And then there was a couple other guys that were Spider-Man. But I was on stage alone and looking out at a sold out crowd at Radio City Music Hall. And I had a monologue about with great power comes great responsibility. And I just remember just kind of taking a moment, feeling how odd of a situation that was. It was just such a cool feeling that, you know, me being kind of an average plus gymnast, now I got to perform on the Radio City Music Hall stage. It was pretty cool. But how do we get from doing that back in the early 2000s to this, to what we're doing now? How'd that happen?
I don't know how that happened because there were as much as we may talk now, I think that's just making up for all the years when we didn't.
I think you're right.
There were a bunch of those, you know? I mean, I don't know. We're both old.
Yeah.
Life kicked in and I don't know. We just got involved with what we did.
But here's the thing. At that point, you weren't a doctor.
No, I didn't even have a degree. I was missing one semester at that point. Yeah, I dropped out initially in college. 3.5 years, I dropped out with one semester to go to move to LA to be a stuntman. So when we did that show, I didn't even have a bachelor's degree at that point.
How'd you get from falling down for a living with no degrees to having 3 degrees for doing performance psychology training with the Army and having your own business that deals with actors and performers in performance psychology training? And what inspired you to do all that?
Yeah, well, life. I got married and with the wife came a kid. She came with a 5-year-old daughter. And stunts was very unpredictable. And at that time, a lot of the work was being shipped out. Some of it was going to Canada, some of it was going to Louisiana, Michigan at the time. There was a lot of work that was moving to other places other than LA. And so it was just harder to get work and to really be sure that the money was going to come in. And with a family, that made me nervous. And I had actually, for a few years, been trying to wrap up the bachelor's degree. And when we got back, actually right after the Spider-Man tour, I went on tour with another live show. It was the Tomb Raider tour. We did Paramount Parks, did that for a few months, and then went straight after that into a movie where I was working. It was a horror film that I did in Atlanta for a couple of weeks. And then right after that, I ended up going to New Jersey to wrap up my degree. I said, you know what? I've got enough money in the bank to go up there and just be for 3-4 months, because that's what it was going to require. And I finished the bachelor's. And after the bachelor's, I came back to LA, and I'd always coached gymnastics off and on. And I was involved in a gym, and actually through the Batman show, there was somebody that we worked with who was involved with a gymnastics camp. And I ended up going to the gymnastics camp, and through that met some people, started coaching at a different gym. And I started coaching team for the first time. And when I was coaching team, I had kids who were hitting regularly on their skills and their routines in practice. And then I'd take them to a meet, and it was like a different kid. I mean, they were wrecking left and right, not all of them, but there were a few that were just predictably not consistent with their performance. And I knew full well that physically they were capable of doing what they were supposed to do. They just weren't. And mental was the only explanation for that. So I started reading about sports psychology. I started reading about just some of the material that was available. And it was interesting. It was really powerful to me how strong the mind is and how much influence it has over our ability to do things in different situations. So I just continued to read. And at one point, I just got, look, if I'm going to read this much, then I might as well get a degree.
It's good logic right there, by the way. That's solid, solid logic.
So I'd finished the bachelor's, and I looked into a master's degree in sports psychology and started that, and just really enjoyed it. I truly did. I enjoyed all the stuff that I was reading and learning. I was easily able to apply it, not just to gymnastics, but to the stunts as well, to everything that I did in terms of training and motivation between jobs and confidence, both between and during jobs. Everything that I was learning in sports psychology was relevant to any number of aspects of my life. And so I really enjoyed that program. And once I finished it, I wasn't done. I wasn't finished learning. I enjoyed the process. So I continued on with a doctorate, and that had some starts and stops along the way, but eventually finished that up 10 years after I started it. And along the way, I ended up working with the Army. I refer to it as performance psychology because I think it's more accurate than sports psychology, because the techniques are the same, but they can be applied to not just athletes, but to business people, to soldiers, to musicians, to actors, singers, dancers. It doesn't matter what type of performance you're engaged in. It just, all these techniques are relevant to helping people be at their best throughout whatever situations they find themselves.
Honestly, like that, it's such a broad scope. It's not just, say, performance, but you're using it in the military so that they're better at their duties or better at their actions or better when they go into battle and into combat. And then those things can probably translate even over to, say, like chefs. Like anytime there's a stressful situation, people are yelling at you, then you like you start making mistakes, or you can use these techniques to kind of focus and do better. So it's amazing that, like you're saying, the concepts and techniques, I don't see them as just a performance thing. They can be used in kind of anything.
Yeah. I mean, the motivation, it doesn't matter what you're talking about. Motivation is critical if you're going to move forward and succeed. Confidence and the belief in your ability to succeed is hugely important. Our self-awareness, our ability to regulate ourselves, being aware of what we're thinking and to manage those thoughts in a way that's productive, and energy levels inside ourselves. Are we able to get to that right level of pumped upness that we need for us to do what we need to do? It doesn't matter what you're talking about, whether it's taking a test in school or, like you said, a chef cooking some meal, or just a, think about it, not even a chef, but just a parent who's cooking dinner and trying to help with homework.
That's true, right?
Just all the thing. If you're going to be at your best, the mental toughness, the mental strength is critical. That's why I say I've really enjoyed learning and continue to enjoy learning about that topic. And I see the application in so many different areas, and to be able to help other people see it as well has been really rewarding. I enjoy it. that's the path with that. And throughout, you know, in terms of us, we started talking and you have a similar interest in the mind and in mental strength and how people think and different perspectives. I don't know. You and I just had some really great conversations over the years that made me think more deeply than I have about some of these topics and in different ways than I have about these topics. And as I've said, that just gets me fired up. I enjoy it.
Me too. Like I said in the beginning, I just love that we can voice our ideas and our concepts. And it doesn't mean like the other person's just going to agree with it. It's nice to be able to say something and then actually get challenged on it and then either have to defend it or realize the absurdity of what we say. One of the reasons that I'm really excited about having an opportunity of doing a podcast and maybe having a bigger reach than my close friends and family is that I've always had some inner discord between the world I see and the world I want to live in and my inability to say something about it to promote some sort of change of consciousness. I just think we as a civilization, we as humanity, I think we can do better. I think we can do better than we have been doing. I think we do better. I'm not saying that we are better. I'm just saying I think we can do better. I think we're smart enough. I think like the last thousands of years have been societies of conquest, like Manifest Destiny, where one society sees what another has and just takes it. I don't want to go back to hunter-gatherer because that's not me. I guess I could gather things. Hey, look at that. I can pick that up. But if we can come together in opposite sides and really give our best on solving problems, then we as humans can solve anything. We solve anything when we come together like that. There's a book, Ayn Rand wrote a book called The Fountainhead. And if I remember my advanced comp class in high school, which is a long time ago, correctly, there's the main characters in the book is really the individual and someone who's just always the good of society, like always, like kind of no individual, no personality, always looking at society. And so in the book, it's like, you got to make a choice, the individual or society. And I don't believe that you need to make a choice. The only society I want to live in is one that values the individual as an individual. But then also we as individuals understand societal systems and how important they are. And for all of us to get together and grow, I think there's a balance and like no one needs to get lost. So that's where my passion is. I want to do something bigger than what I have been doing. And I want to hopefully affect change in a positive way.
Yeah. And I think that this can be a great platform for that. That's why I'm excited about it, is to have a platform to discuss some of these things in ways that I don't think that they have been discussed. I believe that sometimes, particularly with the polarized political environment that we live in, a lot of important issues are only discussed and thought about and argued from two perspectives. Again, I mentioned it before, the world is a complex place. There are a lot of different ways to understand and to see and to think about these different issues that are going on. And I think the more discussion we have among smart people about how we can handle these things more effectively, everybody benefits. And to get to your point too of individual versus society, yeah, I don't agree that there's an either or there either. I agree with you that we are individuals, but we are also part of this larger society. And even within that, it's like concentric circles. We as an individual are in the middle, and then just outside of us is our family, and just outside of that is, you know, our neighborhood, and outside of that is our town and our state and our country. Like there are concentric circles that continue to widen, and we're part of all of these. And the more we can recognize that we as individuals are inseparable from these groups, and some of these groups are inseparable from the larger groups, I think the better off we'll be, the more compassion we'll have, the more willing will be to really take into account other people's perspectives and worry less about what may be best for us and think more about what might be best long-term, big picture, overall for everybody involved.
I agree. Talking about complexity, did you ever watch The Good Place with Kristen Bell?
No.
It's a TV show. It's so great. But basically, without getting too many details about it, no one's gone to heaven. And thousands of years. And one of the reasons that no one's gone to heaven is because there is such complexity in every decision that we make. So the Kristen Bell's character, you got to see it. This is pretty complicated, but I'll just get to her quote. She didn't go to heaven. She's in hell. And it's talking about the reason people are in hell is because of bad choices they've made. And she's like, life is so complicated. Because back when she was alive, she would go to this place that make the best chicken sandwiches on the planet. She would go and she would buy this chicken sandwich from this guy who farms his crops organically. He gets it from local farmers and there's no pesticides and it's all the best of trying to be nice for the planet. The chicken is raised humanely. So she goes and gets chicken there, but he is a bigot. And I think he was a racist and probably a homophobe too. And she's like, ah, but the chicken sandwiches are so good. So in her life story, that is a negative choice that counts against her. And one of the reasons why she's in hell, she's like, but there's all these other things, but you know, he's a racist. How do you take into consideration all of the complexities of our decisions? And when people don't think decisions are complex, when you think they're just black and white, they're not. Everything's gray area. And the more understanding and knowledge that we have on that, the better decisions that we can make.
Well, let's talk about that for a minute. Let's talk about the black and white and let's do it in terms of abortion.
Okay.
So what just happened is that the Supreme Court overturned Roe versus Wade, which guaranteed a woman's right to an abortion. Women no longer have a right to an abortion federally. And the Supreme Court's turned it over to the states to determine what can and can't be done with regard to abortion. The way that I understand it, and I could be completely wrong, is that the Supreme Court disengaged from the discussion. In other words, it said that the federal government, the Constitution says nothing about abortion, and so therefore we're not going to make any laws about abortion. And the states can figure out whatever they want to do. Many people will think about this issue in terms of black and white, like you should or you shouldn't, but I think there is a lot of gray in there.
A comment that a friend said, you can come together about trying to tell a woman what she has to do with what she gets to do with her body, but you can't figure out a way of stifling mass shootings. Where are you spending your time? Just the come and take it mentality. It's like, come and take it. And then you have all these mass shootings, but then when it comes to a woman's right to choose for herself, that's when we can come together and figure out like, nah, you don't get to decide anymore.
Yeah. I mean, I think that that's an interesting point because you're right. It comes down to values. What do we care about? And if you were to ask somebody who's in favor of abortion, then they may say that the bigger challenge to this country is guns. Like we have people dying every day with guns and there's no reason why we should have that happening or violent crime in general or whatever it is, but they care about something other than abortion. They don't see abortion as a problem at all. In fact, they see it as modern technology, modern medicine, helping make life better and reduce suffering for many people. So it all comes down to what we focus on, what we value, what we choose to care about. And that's why I think there are such different perspectives. And this is why the conversation needs to happen for sure. And then not just be on the surface and not just be polarizing. And how did Adam Grant talk about it? Like prosecutorial.
Oh, right.
We don't need to preach at people. We don't need to prosecute people. We don't need to politic people. We need to just think openly and honestly.
And be scientists about it.
And be scientists. Assess the information, gather as much as we can, think about it critically, question the information we have, integrate it into the knowledge we already have obtained, and make the best decisions we can, knowing that even that decision is still open for interpretation given new information that might come in. And I think that too many people are stuck in these two separate camps and that discussion isn't happening. And I think that the values piece is a big part of it. I think that we may be arguing about apples and oranges. Should abortion be legal? I don't know if that's the right question to ask or not. And I'm genuinely thinking out loud right here. I don't know if that's the right question to ask. Maybe the right question to ask is, should people get abortion? Is abortion a morally and ethically sound thing to do? Is getting an abortion moral and ethical? Maybe that would be the better question. And if the answer is yes, okay, why? If the answer is no, why? If we had that discussion about morals and ethics, we would have to define what is the moral or ethic that we are valuing over others. So, for example, if I am in favor of women getting abortion, I'm in the part where, you know, I think that it's a great medical treatment that allows women to
take control of what happens to their bodies,
which allows them to control their lives and to move forward and flourish and reduce their suffering. If that's the camp that I'm in, then maybe that's part of what I believe is valuable, is creating conditions for people to self-actualize, to be self-determined.
Right. To make the decisions and to thrive in their own situations and to look realistically at it, really talking about whether bringing a child into this world or not.
Well, yeah. And the flip side is, if I'm in the camp of abortion is morally and ethically wrong, then why? And maybe my answer is because it's ending a life, and life is the most valuable thing. And the life of a child begins at this certain point, and by ending it whenever you end it, that's immoral. It's unethical, because this creature can't make decisions for itself, and we are infringing on its rights as a person for self-actualization. So again, it's a complex and complicated situation that deserves more nuanced discussion, I think.
Kind of heading down that road, if you're in the camp about abortion being morally and ethically wrong, where are you putting your value of life, right? So if it's a situation when that child is going to be born, and then that child, because this parent's situation, has to go into foster care or gets up for adoption, and then you're looking at the quality of life there or what that does to the mother, I would like to point out that two guys having a discussion about abortion is also like we're treading on some water. It'd be nice if we had, maybe at some point in the future, we could have like a female voice along with ours, which would be helpful.
I think it would be interesting, but I'll just go ahead and say, I think that there's nothing wrong with men talking about whether abortion is right or wrong. I will say that in terms of the legality of abortion, one of the things that, forget if it was Alito or Clarence Thomas, but one of them wrote, the decision really hinged on the fact that the word abortion was not in the Constitution, and so therefore wasn't protected by the Constitution, which could get us into a whole other discussion, and maybe will one day, on just the dumbness of making laws just based on the few words that people in the 18th century wrote in this document, as opposed to the overall intent and really what was meant and what in this day and age will be beneficial for our society. But that's neither here nor there. The point is, if you are going to subscribe to the fact that what is actually written in the Constitution is all that really matters, you have to take into account the fact that the Constitution was only written. All of these things were only considered by men in a very, very, very patriarchal society where women had basically no rights whatsoever and had no voice in the discussion of the creation of those laws.
We're based in our modern society of men and women, and we're trying to see each other as equals. And then the overall structure of that is coming down from the Constitution, as you said, which is just written by men. I'd never even thought about it like that. It's just one-sided. And of course, they're great men, and I'm sure they took women consideration in that. But ultimately, it was written by men. And so where is the female voice in that?
Well, I don't know that they did take women into consideration. Why would they? I mean, they would have taken women into consideration to the extent that women were important as they understood them back in the 18th century.
I guess I'm just saying it for hope. I hope we weren't all the men were all assholes and, you know, just didn't care about women's feelings. And I would just hope.
Yeah. You know, you can't expect them to behave in a way that the society was what it was and they knew what they knew. You know, we don't know what we don't know. And at the time, that society and the values were what they were, and women had the place that they did. And there was no way for those individuals to predict how women's place within our society would change over the years. They couldn't predict that. And so they did the best they could with what they had, which I think was pretty good. But I think for those constitutional literalists, I think that they're putting a whole lot of eggs in this very old basket created by a very limited range of people.
Almost aristocracy.
Yeah.
Bunch of rich white guys, you know, that made the document.
So I will say that in terms of the Constitution and abortion and legality and laws, absolutely, I think that women and female perspectives need to be considered because they weren't when the Constitution was written, but they need to be now. However, as far as whether or not abortion is morally ethical or not, morally ethical is moral or ethical, or not.
Right.
I think that's a question for everybody.
Yeah.
And although men and women may come at it differently, I think there's no reason to invalidate men's opinions on life and the importance of life and when life begins and at what point we value a baby over a woman or a woman over a baby. Like, I mean, all of these are very difficult questions. And I think that different perspectives, men and women's, are important. I don't know that one is more important than the other, I guess is what I'm saying.
We shouldn't negate the fact that we're two white guys talking about this. Everyone's opinion should be taken into consideration, especially since it wasn't when the Constitution was written. I think that's a really valid point. I'll tell you something that I heard. This is someone who is for pro-life as opposed to pro-choice and talking about how they believe that the doctors are pro-choice because of the money that they make off of abortions. That was the perspective this pro-lifer had. Say they don't want, the doctors of the abortion clinics don't want this to go away because this is how they make all of their money and there's a lot of money in it. I think that kind of mentality, that seems kind of propaganda to me. That seems like this has been told to this person that this is why people are not pro-choice. That's what you're putting your time in. You're choosing what women get to do with their body, or you're choosing when you think life starts. That's not what you're putting your time in. You're going to put your time and effort about how you think, no, doctors don't want this to go away because they make millions doing this. It's like, that's kind of the perception that I hope what we do and how we talk about it, that we maybe open our own eyes to our own blind spots in these self-justification misconceptions, but also like, that's why discussions are important. And when you're only getting your information from a single source, then your perception is going to be skewed to that source. I hope even in this conversation about abortion, it's like, let's keep talking about it. Let's try to get beyond our own misconceptions about our perception on abortion.
Yeah. And those sources of information you just mentioned are really important. And the propaganda and what people listen to, because it takes me back. It made me think about what we were talking about earlier with regard to mistakes. When a politician or public figure admits to a mistake, they are crucified by whoever is against them. And it depends on who the person is. But let's say a Democrat says, I did something wrong. Well, they're going to be eviscerated by Republicans. And that's just going to be what happens. I don't know that it should be what happens, but it's what happens. So in terms of public opinion and whether or not that openness and that willingness to say I was wrong, to admit mistakes, whether that turns into a closeness like we talked about it can in terms of relationships, whether it strengthens people's opinions of you or if it makes you appear weak and wishy-washy, will depend on the way that it's spun by the information sources. So if all people did was listen to the person's apology and took it at face value, which is another thing. I think there's a lot of cynicism in our society today, especially when you see politicians apologizing for things.
If my actions happen to be any sort of cause any problems or conflicts, then, you know, I'm sorry. I'm sorry about that. You know, like, oh, yeah, that was really sincere. Yeah, nice. Nice way to sell it.
Well, and some of them are very good at selling it. And just because we know that they are good at selling, they have to be good on TV to get elected. Most of them at the higher levels, it's just there's a lot of cynicism in terms of the extent to which we're willing to believe and accept somebody's apology. It's funny. One of the questions that I listened to Sam Harris's podcast, Making Sense, a lot. And one of the questions he asks people a lot is, you know, how do we get around that? Like, how do people come back from a mistake? What's the process for that? At what point do we let them out of the doghouse? What do they have to do in order for us as a society to forgive and move on? Not forget, but forgive and move on. What do we have to do?
I think one of the problems is people look for an equation. You know, you look for an equation, like if you do this and you do this and you do this, then we'll accept you back. But I think it comes down to the situation. It comes down to the person's response for it and how they do that. And mistakes were made, but not by me, was talking about what happened with the Abu Ghraib. Is that the one? Yeah, Abu Ghraib. Yeah. The government stance is we don't torture. Government stance is we don't torture. It's like we just have advanced interrogation techniques. You know, so they never admitted it. But then there was one of the military officers that was there and he just came out and said it. He's like, hey, I tortured. I did this. And now what he's done with that is he's not forgetting it because he wants it to be a lesson. And he is now a professor and he teaches a course and talks about atonement, or I don't know if he uses that word, but what you do is like learn from these mistakes. When he admits it and he goes full on into accepting it and now trying to affect positive change with that, then of course, you know, we as a society accept the fact that he did a mistake. One of the other examples they used is how a guy was texting and driving and he ended up being a car crash and killing the other people in the other car. And since then, how he's now been a proponent and he goes and talks to anyone who will listen about not texting and driving and how dangerous it is and accepted his responsibility for it and then affected positive changes to make the world a better place and raise awareness about that. So those are extreme cases. But then back to your question, it's like, how do you fix the problem? And then how do you accept it?
Sam Harris talked about it. He's used many examples, but one that really resonated with me is it's more related to these hot button issues like Black Lives Matter or the Me Too move. Like there's just some stuff that's out there that is just, it's a third rail. And if you say the wrong thing or you land on the wrong side of whatever the prevailing wisdom is, then you're torn apart. And one of the examples he mentioned was something that Matt Damon said and was ripped up for.
He's a great actor, by the way. He's a great actor. I like him.
I think he is too.
He's great.
Love to double him. Matt, if you're listening to this, I'm there for you. Anyway, how about that for a shameless plug?
Nice.
Anyway, what he said was something to the effect, this is not a quote, but something to the effect that grabbing somebody's ass is not the same as raping them. And we just need to acknowledge that. They're not the same thing. Well, that did not go over in anybody's mind. I mean, it makes perfect sense, right? There are gradations of bad. We have that in everything else within our society. As you mentioned before, black and white is we did something that violated somebody or we didn't. And they're getting both treated the same way.
It's not the equal to the crime. Everyone's getting treated the same for the wide range of offenses. Yeah.
Yeah. And so even just trying to make sense out of something. Another example that came up, was it Kathy Griffin? I think it is. That's the name that's popping in my head. No, Megyn Kelly. That's who I'm thinking of. Megyn Kelly. I think that this was the situation. We can look it up later. But she said, she just questioned. I mean, seemingly, honestly questioned. Look, if I'm going to go out for Halloween as Diana Ross, how come I can't put brown makeup on myself to go make myself look like Diana Ross? Again, crucified. I mean, there just seemed to be a genuine question of, I'm disguising myself for this holiday. How come I can't disguise myself in this way? And so again, just ripped apart and then issued what seemed to be a pretty, it was a heartfelt, in my opinion, a heartfelt apology of, look, I wasn't aware of the sensitivity of the situation, whether it should be sensitive or not. I wasn't aware of how my words would be taken, but the bottom line was she just acknowledged that what she intended to do is not what she actually did and felt bad about it. But she was not let off the hook at all for that.
Well, we're talking about like cancel culture, you know, it's like just jumping on it for anyone to say anything bad and just get ridiculed. I think it's important to have a sensitivity on issues. There is a poster that I saw, it was kind of cool. It was like an equalizer poster saying like, women's rights are human's rights. Black rights are human rights. We should all have the same rights and we should all have the same considerations. So that part is important.
But do you know how many people would disagree with that? That's the point, is that there are a lot of groups that really value the group. The tribalism that exists is really important. They want to distinguish themselves. And this is topic for a whole nother podcast too, of race and when we're black and when we're white, like where's the line? There doesn't seem to be a very clear line between black people and white people. There just doesn't. I was listening to, forget the guy's name, but his parents were mixed race. He had a white mom and black dad. And he married a white woman. So his kids came out blonde hair and blue eyed. But if you look at him, like, he's lived a black life. That's the life that he's had. So it's just an interesting point of the importance that some people place on being in these groups. First of all, let me just say, I absolutely agree with you that what I would love for us to get to is just a universal cosmopolitan attitude. We are a world society. That's what we are. As human beings, that's our group.
Yeah.
That's our tribe. Our tribe is
humans. We're humans. What tribe are you in? Humans? Oh, that's awesome. I'm in that tribe too.
That's all we are. So to me, that's the ideal.
Yeah.
So I'm just saying, so I agree with what you're saying with the equalizing, with the cosmopolitan nature of unifying everybody. But there are many people who would argue against that.
My question is to you then, how can we get back to a human, like you were proposing, like, hey, we're all part of the human tribe.
Hey, brother, if I knew that, I would publish it and I'd get the next Nobel Prize. That is for sure. That's a question a lot of people are working on, and it's not going to happen overnight. And in my opinion, the only way that it can happen is if we start to come together on our values as a community, as a whole. And the bigger we get, the more up the chain we go in terms of those values, we have to do something that we can all agree on. By that, I mean the value of independence. So can we all get around independence? We should have independence. Well, no, because other countries don't value independence. All right. Well, where can we plant a flag that all of humanity can agree? Yeah, that's a good idea right there.
Well, I mean, think about freedom. The U.S. is like, I think that's one of the things that really define us is our pursuit of freedom. And I think it's a great thing, but like every pursuit, it can go too far. So if it's not independence, if it's not freedom, I don't know if it's really a value thing, but one of the things that you're talking about with the concentric circles is if we see the whole world as the same system. And so it's like, it goes from the smallest system, like our bodies, like our fingernails, the system of the finger, and our fingers, the system of the hand. And they're all systems within themselves, but they're all make up the system of who I am. And then how yeah. I'm a system of the society and the people around me. And then the people around me are a system of the country. So it's like, it all starts from the infinitesimal. Is that the right word? Infinitesimal?
Infinitesimal.
Infinitesimal. That's the word. Thank you. It all starts with the infinitesimal. I'm so glad you're here and that you're a doctor and you can call me out on words that I say incorrectly. I'm very happy about that. Actually, I'm being sincere because I say things wrong all the time. And if I say I'm wrong, I would hope someone calls me on it. So then I don't keep saying infinitesimal when that's not the word. So, but saying, so you start with the small, maybe I'll just use an easier word, and it keeps growing to the big. And so I think if we start seeing ourselves and the things that are close to us, the things that are far from us, the things that are distant from us, if we're all maybe seeing that we're all part of the same system, then we would start acting like, okay, how do I keep this system going? Or how do I make this system better?
Yeah. And so I'll just go back to my analogy I had earlier, which is the same as yours, but just with different terminology. So I've got me.
Are they bigger terminology? Like, can you use bigger words? No. Or can
possible.
You use smaller words so I can understand it?
There'll be a nice mixture for you.
Maybe we can have like a glossary term at the end.
Well, there aren't going to be any if you don't shut the hell up and let me talk. Okay. There will be no words.
All right. All right. Good point.
Yeah. So I'm starting with me, right? I'm me. I'm an individual. And I have my values and things that I care about. And then there's my family. I can then assess, all right, so well, what are the values of my family? What are my family values? And then I can go outside of that to the neighborhood or a little bit larger, maybe the town. Like, what does the town care about? What are the things that are important to the town? And at each step, see where the overlap is.
Mm-hmm.
What are the values that I hold that are the same as the family values? And what are the family values that are the same as of those values that are the same? Which of those values are the same as the town that I live in? And of those values, which of those values is the same as the state that I live in? And of those values, which of those values is the same as the country? And just keep going out like that until we figure out, you know, all right, well, globally, what are the things that we all care about? And what are we trying to achieve? Like, what are the similarities? What are the goals that each of us, no matter where we are located on this planet, is striving for? And one of the things that's been thrown out there for years and years is the idea of happiness or well-being. Aristotle coined the term eudaimonia. It's this idea of thriving, flourishing at a deep level, not a surface, like I'm happy in the moment level, but at a life level. And that's something that philosophers have been discussing for forever. And if we can agree, okay, well, that's where we're going. How do we get there becomes the question. What things do we value? There has been some research done on that. There were two researchers, Martin Seligman and Chris Peterson, actually did work in the positive psychology realm. And they did research around the globe on character strengths is what they call them. But they went to these different cultures, 50-something cultures, I believe, the first time. And the study was replicated later, too, with 70-something cultures. But the whole purpose was to identify what the values are within these cultures that are common across culture around the globe. And they identified 24, and they called them character strengths. And there's actually an assessment, a couple of them from two different organizations, actually, called the Values in Action Survey, where you take it and it lets you know what your character strengths are. For example, creativity, ingenuity, originality is one. Honesty, authenticity, genuineness, modesty and humility, humor and playfulness. So these are some of those values that were important to cultures around the globe. I think if we can identify those things and really try to structure discussion around and create systems that embody those values that everybody cares about, maybe we get closer to that global society. You know, it's hard even talking about globalness when we can't even get straight in our own country. We can't even get on the same team there.
If we can find commonalities between all cultures, with commonality comes more discussion and more openness and more understanding. And maybe through our commonalities of what makes us more the same as opposed to what's different, and that's how we can maybe move society into a one of enlightenment as opposed to the one that it is right now of conquest. Because we're still in a conquest society. I think there's a lot of push to try to be smarter. You know, we want to be smarter humans. But I still think we have still a conquest ideology just as a society. I mean, if you look at Ukraine, what's Putin thinking? How does Putin think invading Ukraine is what's best for his country, for him? I don't know, dude. I don't know.
Yeah. To me, I think that discussions about trying to bring everybody together in a cosmopolitan way, a global society where everybody gets along.
I mean, you keep using that word. What does it mean? Cosmopolitan. What are you talking about?
It means, but that's the global nature, like the bigger city. Like,
if only we could look it up. It's almost like, you keep using that word. I don't think it means what you think it means.
Yeah. Derives from the Greek word cosmopolitis, citizen of the world. Yeah. World civilization, world society. Okay. Like that's what it is that we're going for. So I think that there's a lot of benefit in that. But I think that change starts small and it starts locally. I don't know. We're just people. We're just who we are. You know, here's just you and me. We're just here talking. And I think that trying to affect change at lower levels, more local levels, is just as important. I think it's useful to have the conversations on the global and societal level, but I think a lot of change can happen at the local level that's really meaningful. But it comes down to, what are our values? What do we care about? What really drives us? Values meaning how we think things should be. Those are our values, like how we think people should act, how the world should be, how we should be. Those are the values that we hold, and they drive everything. They color our perceptions. They direct our attention. They influence our beliefs and thoughts and decisions that we make on a regular basis. Values are tremendous. And so many people, if you were to stop them on the street and ask them, like, what are your values? They might be hard pressed to tell you what the values are that they truly care about, the things that really are at the heart of who they are. That really, I mean, think about what books you read, what movies you watch, you know, how you interact with your kids, how you choose to discipline your kids. These are all tied to the values that we hold. And without a really firm grasp on what those values are and the ability to work together with those same values within a community, we're just going to be at odds. And I think that's where a lot of the polarization is within our society is just, the values are different. People care about different things.
Well, I would agree with that. But I think just as important as recognizing what our values are, is our ability to self-justify the incongruities of how we think about our values or how we act about our values. Like in the book, Mistakes Were Made, But Not By Me, one of the things that they pointed out in the book was like the autism scare of the early 2000s, the autism and vaccination scare. The science now is that there is no correlation in between vaccinations and autism. The head scientist who was the leader of the research team got $800,000 to find if there was a correlation between autism and vaccinations. And he found one. And the other 13 scientists who signed off on this article, 10 of them later on recanted because they said, we didn't know the lead scientist was getting money to find this from someone who wants to find a correlation between the two. And that would have affected our decision. And the lead scientist was like, no, there was no conflict of interest. And so it's like big things like that, like the values are, of course, trying to save kids from getting autism, what I would assume would be the big value. But then because of the conflict of interest, because of the way it went down, and if you guys are really interested, you should just get the book because I'm doing a horrible job explaining what the whole situation was. But how our self-justifications help us not live up to the values that we actually believe. And so I think recognizing what values are important are just as important as trying to find our own blind spots with the confirmation bias in our own perception of how we act upon our values.
Yeah, well, let me just say a couple things about that. First, the confirmation bias is our tendency to notice and remember and put a lot of importance on evidence that supports our belief. Naturally, we just walk through the world and the evidence that supports our belief naturally sticks to us. While evidence that doesn't support our belief, we either don't notice it at all or don't remember it or downplay the importance of it. That's the confirmation bias. This is a tendency that we all have. It happens unconsciously. It happens outside of our awareness. And in the situation that you're talking about with the self-justification, I don't see it as people justifying behavior that goes against their values. What they're doing is explaining how their behavior that seems to go against their values is actually aligned with their values. Like they figure out a way to justify what they did. So alleviate cognitive dissonance.
Yes, I understand to alleviate cognitive dissonance, but it's just like their actions are opposed to their values. And so therefore you have the self-justification of those actions. And you said the same thing, but you kind of reversed it and put how you justify the actions to make it look like they are in line with your values as opposed to without the values. I mean, we're saying the same thing.
Yeah, well, but the point is that these people, it's not cosmetic. They're not trying to fool anybody. They truly believe.
Yeah.
That's what it comes down to. That's the fascinating part, is that when we behave in ways that go against our values, we experience cognitive dissonance. In other words, if I think that I should behave this way, but I actually behave that way, then I'm going to experience cognitive dissonance. And I can alleviate that cognitive dissonance in one of two ways. I can either change my belief about how I should behave to match how I actually did behave, or I can change my understanding or explanation or interpretation or reasons for my behavior to make it so that that behavior is no longer incongruent with the value.
Right.
Those are my two choices. And that's where self-justification comes in. Like, for example, let's say I tell my daughter she can play with her friends after she cleans her room. I get busy with something, an hour goes by, and I notice my daughter playing with her friends. So I go check her room and realize that the room hasn't been touched. No cleaning whatsoever has happened. So I make a beeline to where she's playing with her friends and I lay into her. Like I yell at her about the fact that I told her to clean her room before playing and she didn't do that, and about how irresponsible she is. And this is right in front of her friends. She starts crying. She runs to her room. So in that situation, I might experience cognitive dissonance because my behaviors didn't match my values. I value my daughter's happiness and well-being, but I just made her cry. I also value treating my daughter with respect, but I just screamed at her about her room and right in front of her friends, no less. So I experience cognitive dissonance. I feel a lot of discomfort. And in order to get rid of that discomfort, I need to justify my behavior. So I tell myself that she should feel miserable because she made a bad choice and did the wrong thing. So misery is a perfectly appropriate and even helpful emotion for her because maybe she'll remember and try to avoid that misery by making better choices and doing the right things in the future. Or I might tell myself that I tried being nice, but since that didn't work, I had no choice but to escalate things by yelling. That was the only way that I could guarantee that I could get her attention and get her to take responsibility and follow through with her commitment, which is also something that I value. And that's another way to self-justify. Yes, I may have violated my value of respect, but it was the only way that I could uphold another value, taking responsibility and following through with commitments. And this self-justification comes naturally. As human beings, we want to reduce suffering. So we do what's necessary to get rid of cognitive dissonance. We reframe, reinterpret our behaviors in ways that make those behaviors line up with how we see ourselves, our values, and our self-identity.
And how do we get beyond that? I think one of the things they propose in the book is just awareness of it. It's kind of almost the same idea as the Think Again book about the power of rethinking. I don't want to be the same person I was yesterday.
Yeah.
I get new opportunities today. And of course, you can't put extra thought in every opportunity because then we would just go insane and never accomplish anything. I want to keep learning and keep being a better tomorrow than I was today.
Yeah. And it's interesting what came to mind while you were talking is those are values that I think need to change in our society. For example, if more people like Adam Grant advocates valued changing their minds, if people changing their minds was seen as a good thing and not a bad thing, which I think it often is, then more people would be open to changing their minds. They wouldn't try as hard to justify and to try to fit this certain perspective into something that doesn't quite fit for them anymore. You know, they'd be more willing to, given the new information that they have, more willingly and easily change their mind and change their belief and change what they think is important and how they see things. But that's just not the society that we live in.
But it can be.
It can be.
We're going to get it there, man. I mean, not just you and me, hopefully other people as well. But can I just say one more thing, though, before we finish this?
Do your thing, man. What you got?
Well, just about the perception about changing our minds. One of the things that I feel about COVID protocols, the CDC will say something, and then a couple weeks later, they'll say something else. And a couple weeks later, say something else. And then when you're talking to people, I don't know what the fucking right protocols is now. They're always changing their mind. And I'm like, yeah, they should change their mind because they get new information. And so if they just stuck with what they thought in the beginning with such limited information and they stick to that just because that's what they said, then that is such a disservice to the additional information that they get. And they're trying to make better decisions. And like you said, if the society was able to accept that, able to accept change and growth, we as a society can be better tomorrow than we are today. That's exciting, dude.
Yeah, and it's a value that I think can exist. And you have it and I have it. And the hope is that, at least my hope, is that through this podcast, we can have a platform that's available for people to listen to who are also willing to change their mind and think about things a little bit differently and be okay saying, I don't know, or wow, you know what? I thought this way, but now I've got this new information, so I'm going to think this other way now. Because like you said, with more information, more knowledge comes more wisdom, and we can make better choices, better decisions, and we should. We would be irresponsible not to. If we disregard the new information that comes at us, all we can do is the best we can with what we got. And if the smart people are telling us what they're telling us, it behooves us to trust those smart people. If they change their mind because they get some new information, okay, well, then we should change our minds with them. I don't know.
Well, and that really comes back to the whole reason that we called this podcast Poking Holes in Blinders, because that's kind of what we're trying to do. We're trying to widen our gaze. We want to take the things that we just accept, the way that we're thinking about something, the cultural mores of our society, and we want to try to poke the holes and get more information and widen the gaze and keep growing and go from there. Like, that's why I'm really excited about the name. I know we talked about the name for a little bit and this is the one we went with and I really like it. It means a lot to me. This name is great. I'm glad you liked it too.
Yeah, the name's grown on me, and I agree. I think that the more strongly held our beliefs, the larger and thicker and more blinding the blinders. We still have access to information, but it's all information that fits with our belief. This is where the confirmation bias comes in. We're limited in terms of what we can see. And so, yeah, my hope really is that we can bring some not only new information, but just new perspectives, just talk about things in ways that they haven't been talked about before, or at least aren't talked about very often, in the hope that that broadens our perspective, widens our thinking, and creates some wisdom that allows for people to make some better choices, ourselves included.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Yeah.
Nothing will make me happier than if we have these conversations and something comes up and I feel like I've walked away. And I usually do when I have conversations with you. This is how I feel. This is why I like talking to you.
I feel the same.
I feel like my perspective has been broadened. I feel like I am a better person for having had the discussion that I've had. Like, I understand things a little bit better, possibly, but certainly in a more nuanced and in-depth way than I did before having the conversation.
For sure.
And that's really the hope for the podcast as well. It's just hopefully people can think about things in ways that they hadn't thought about it before, and that those different ways they'll find beneficial.
Well, I know I found it beneficial. You know what? We just did it, man. We just did our first podcast.
First one done. Took a long time.
Took a long time.
But you know what? It was a great time, and I'm looking forward to doing it again soon.
We'll definitely do it again. So thank you for listening to Poking Holes in Blinders. You can find us on a myriad of websites. One of them is our own website, pokingholesinblinders.org. You also find us on podbean.com. And Brian, you got another website too, don't you?
Yeah, it's www.beginagainperformancepsychology.com. So if you're an athlete, parent of an athlete, or a performer, singer, dancer, actor, musician, whatever, and experiencing any challenges, confidence, motivation, performance anxiety, just want to take your game to the next level, come visit us. Take a look at the website, see what it is that we offer, and sign up for a free session. We'd love to talk to you.
Sounds great, man. So thanks again for listening to Poking Holes in Blinders. And remember, knowledge infused with compassion fuels better decisions.